Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Hello and welcome to Lost in Science for another week. My name is Claire and, of course, we're going to be chatting to you about all types of science today. I'm here with Chris. Hello.
Hi, Claire. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty well. How are you?
You know, yes, I'm well as well. This is such a heartwarming conversation that we both are in.
It is heartwarming because, as we know, Chris, it's the year is 2025. Mm-hmm. It is the year of quantum physics, and you are our resident neighborhood friendly quantum physicist.
Yes. True? Yes, I'll claim that. I'll claim that mantle.
And we have. We are celebrating the year of 2025 with our resident quantum physicist, Chris Lessig, by doing a sometimes show, well, what that I like to call Chris's Quantum Science for Dummies, me being the dummy in this situation.
Or, like, what does any of this mean and why should I care?
What is up with this?
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And... parentheses, why should I care, in parentheses. So that's what we're going to be doing today, is it not?
It is. Well, that's part of what we're going to be doing. What else are we going to be doing, though, is the question.
Well, the other part of what we're going to be doing is we're taking an interview from the vault from 2023 when Stu...
Can I do the vault noise?
Yeah, I think you just did.
Okay.
And Stu interviewed Dr. Ellie Payne, who is a phycologist and marine biologist, and Stu and her had a fascinating conversation a couple of years ago about the opportunity for using giant kelp as a way to draw carbon and capture it as carbon and then sink it down into the ocean.
Like seaweed?
Yeah, seaweed. So we are going to be revisiting that conversation, bring it back out of the vaults because it's a fascinating one, and it's really interesting hearing about these new innovative ways to tackle climate change, and also think through, well, are they actually going to work and what are the limiting factors here, and what can we do about it? So that is what else is on the show today this week, Chris. So strap in, get your quantum ready, because we're going for a ride, I guess. So, Chris, as I said in the intro, it is International Year of Quantum Physics and Quantum Research, I believe.
Quantum Science and Technology, I think. Maybe.
Quantum Science and Technology. Thank you. Maybe you should be doing
That's what I'm here for.
Well, so a couple of months ago, we started our conversation with my, this series of Quantum Science for Dummies, and you talked me through a little bit about what quantum science is, why it's important, and then I think we ended up chatting about teleportation, which was also...
I'm not sure how we got on teleportation. It is a quantum thing, obviously, but I'm not sure how we got onto...
But we're coming back to it, because there's a lot to talk about when it comes to quantum, and I still feel like I need some skilling up, Chris. Okay. Can you help me?
I can try. Well... Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think we discussed how, like, this is all about what Werner Heisenberg did in the year 1925. So it's the 100 years anniversary of that, his formulation of quantum physics that he did, or quantum mechanics that he did in that year. So I think Heisenberg is a good place to start.
Heisenberg. Let's get into it.
Do you know what he's most famous for?
I'm a little bit uncertain.
I see what you did there.
Okay.
Yeah, like most people have heard of Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And I don't know how much you know about what that means.
I mean, is it just what's written on the label?
Yeah, I suppose to a certain extent.
That you can't be certain. Is it something to do with the duality of measuring photons and waves, that sort of thing?
It's all connected, you know. Okay. If we could draw a big map, it would all be connected. Yeah, it's totally. It expresses a number of things. One is just simply the fact that in the quantum world, there is a lot of randomness and uncertainty, and it's kind of inherently fuzzy, I suppose, in that sense. But the fuzziness depends on the way that you're looking at things. And specifically with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, it's basically the most common kind of people know of it is that you can't know the position of a particle and its momentum precisely at the same time. Like there is a connection. Like the more precisely you know the position of something, the less precisely you know its momentum, you know, just like to its velocity and that sort of thing, the way it's moving. And similarly, the better you know its momentum or its velocity, then the less certain you are about its position.
Right. Applies to very small things.
Yeah, as it applies to very small things. Because, yeah, the equation has like an amount that connects these things, and it's quite a small little factor. So it really only applies at that small level. But, yeah, it's related to the wave and particle thing, because a wave, a thing could be a particle or a wave, and the particle is like a little point. And so its position, as you can imagine, is fairly well known. You can say this is the particle here. It's this one little point in space, whereas a wave is like it's a thing with a known frequency, and the frequency is related to its energy and its momentum. It's going in a particular direction. A wave has a fairly well defined momentum, I suppose, is what you're saying. So when something is acting like a wave, you know its momentum, but you don't know where it is. It's spread out as a wave. When something is narrowed down to a particle, you know exactly where it is, but it could just be, you don't actually know which direction it's moving in or how fast it's moving. You just narrowed it down to that one point in time, I suppose.
Right. And so why was this so revolutionary at the time? This is just like a whole new way of thinking about the world.
I suppose because it did give that underlying... conceptually, I suppose, it is that thing that you can't know everything about these quantum entities precisely. And like, you know, as much as we say they can be a wave sometimes, a particle other times, I guess we tend to think of them as particles. And the idea that a particle can't have a defined position, precise position and momentum is... You know, that's not our conception of how you think you should be able to know. But it turns out, yeah, you cannot... know that it's a limit on how the universe works, I suppose. They're not these tiny little kind of billiard balls as we think of them. They act differently. And I think it's more the conceptual thing, I suppose. In a practical sense, it does affect, yeah, I guess the kind of measurements you can do. There is the reason it's with position momentum is because they have a particular relationship, those two quantities. There's a similar kind of relationship between energy and time. It's a similar kind of thing. And various other things that you might measure, they're kind of, I suppose, yeah, they're complementary in some way, these different quantities.
And does it just infuriate physicists no end that you cannot do both these things, that uncertainty principle exists? Like, it just sounds infuriating.
Well, I mean, you get used to it, I guess.
You sort of get used to the nature of things when they're revealed. Yeah.
But it's all connected with the stuff that, you know, that say Einstein had an issue with about you know, God does not play dice with the universe. You know, there's this inherent randomness. A lot of these kind of exaggerated quotes. I mean, he said a lot of these things, but they're kind of taken out of context. And, you know, he knew what was going on, but he didn't necessarily agree with it totally. And, you know, his famous thing, the EPR thought experiment, which is all about when you've got entangled particles, so two kind of quantum systems that are separated, and what you know about one affects what you can know about the other, and you're looking at, in that sort of things, you're looking at these kind of, not exactly position and momentum, but similar kind of quantities that have that relationship. And so basically, just this is, absolutely not the example they give, but you have, if you had these entangled things and they're connected and they had the same value for these things, you measure the position of one, you know that the position of the other one is exactly defined and the momentum isn't, even though it's could be a long way away, like in the other side of the universe. Even you know exactly that if you know, if you made a measurement on this one, that what can be known about the other one, even though it's on the other side of the universe, potentially. And that was something that Einstein, as you can imagine, didn't agree with, because he thought, you know, like a lot of people think, there should be these fundamental quantities, there should be these knowable things. They might be hidden. People talk about hidden variables, but there should be these, these fundamental kind of values to everything. And the best experiments we can do indicate that that's not really the case. The quantum stuff is real.
I understand Heisenberg was a mathematician or was a physicist?
Theoretical physicist.
Okay, yeah. So was the uncertainty principle mostly a theory? It must have been, it is a theory, but it must have some experimental evidence to support it. What was that? What is that?
Well, I guess when you can think about these things, like, you know, the position being uncertain is where you can get these things like a particle jumping from one place to another. You know, you get quantum tunneling is one of the things that I don't know if you've heard of, where a particle can jump through a barrier effectively.
Teleportation?
No, this is ordinary, just
ordinary particle jumping.
Ordinary particle jumping, yeah. It's only at a very small distances. Mm-hmm. Only very small distances. And this is one of the things where people like to talk about there being practical applications for these things. This is one of the thinnest ones for practical applications for me, is that, you know, when you've got your USB drive that has like information stored in, you know, digital circuits and that sort of thing in semiconductors, to delete the information off, you basically have to get all the particles to jump essentially through a barrier that's holding them in place, and to wipe all the information. And that's sort of done. When you delete the information off your USB drive, you're using quantum tunneling to do that.
Right.
Yeah. Similarly, when you think an electron microscope also uses it, when they have like a little tip, sort of probe tip, and you measure something on a surface by the electrons jumping across the gap from the tip to the surface. Mm. That's tunneling. They're crossing a gap that they shouldn't otherwise be able to cross. So, yeah, it is a real thing, and it is seen in practice. I suppose from Heisenberg's point of view, it's more to do with, I guess, the mathematics and the fundamental rules that govern how these things behave. And it's part of, I guess, just a feature of the way that things behave.
Just a feature of the universe.
Not a bug.
All right, Chris. Well, I think I have a little bit more of a nuanced understanding of what Heisenberg, why his theory is so great, if not a little bit uncertain. I reckon, Chris, next time on Chris's Guide to Quantum Physics for Dummies, the dummy being me, we should get into some more of the practical applications of quantum physics, because it's fascinating to hear about them. I mean, electron microscopes, clearing all the information out of my USBs.
So important.
But they're everyday things. Mm. I love hearing about that stuff. Yep. So can we talk about that next time?
Totally, yeah.
Except for a single, very powerful radio emission.
Of course, a transmitter of that sort isn't exactly standard equipment.
The science and technology must be absolutely mind-boggling.
Of course, that's mostly on the theoretical side.
Well, so far.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you're listening to Lost in Science.
So I've got with me today Dr. Ellie Payne from the University of Tasmania. Thanks for joining us on Lost in Science.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
The first thing I want to ask is, why on earth would anyone want to grow seaweed?
Yeah, so seaweed is a really important part of the marine ecosystem. It performs a lot of roles in the marine environment, such as a habitat for marine life, as well as performing really important nutrient cycling roles. So it takes up carbon dioxide out of the seawater and then converts it into organic carbon, which can then be stored within the seaweed tissue and used for, you know, growth or reproduction. And then it can also be released back into the seawater as organic carbon or dissolved organic carbon, which is contributing to the biological carbon cycle. It also takes up nitrogen, so nutrients from the seawater. And that is really important when you consider putting seaweed around, you know, there's these trials putting seaweed around fish farms where they're wanting to take up those extra nutrients that the salmon in Tasmania are releasing. And then the seaweeds are able to take up that excess nutrients out of the water and then convert it into biomass, seaweed biomass. But in the context of ocean afforestation, which is what my paper was about, ocean afforestation, it's actually a method of carbon dioxide removal. So in particular, people are wanting to grow seaweed to take up that extra carbon dioxide, which is in the seawater.
But what were you actually trying to find out with your research?
So this paper was looking at ocean afforestation in particular, and that is when you're growing seaweed offshore, so that is off the continental shelf, so in the open ocean, at great scale for the purpose of carbon dioxide removal. So that seaweed can be grown on either a static structure, so if you consider potentially a unused old oil rig, or a floating structure where it's going to float with the currents. And we wanted to actually look at whether the iron concentrations in the open ocean are able to support seaweed growth, because iron, we already know, and this has been recorded in the literature for 20 years now, that the iron availability in the open ocean does not support the phytoplankton growth out there. So it actually limits primary productivity in the open ocean. And we see these regions that are high nutrient, low chlorophyll, because the phytoplankton can't actually grow and take up all of that nitrogen and phosphate in the open ocean. So you see really low productivity in these regions. And no one had considered this in terms of growing seaweed out in the open ocean. So we thought, we're going to have to do some kind of laboratory experiment here, small scale, that can then translate to these different companies that are actually investing a lot of money into growing seaweed in the open ocean.
What is the difference between phytoplankton and what is phytoplankton?
Yeah, absolutely. No worries. So phytoplankton are microalgae. So they are microscopic algae that are free floating and they live everywhere. So in freshwater environments, in saltwater environments, estuaries, and they actually contribute approximately half of the oxygen that we breathe. So they are photosynthesizing. And they're, you know, converting sunlight into energy and taking up carbon dioxide and dividing and making this beautiful organic carbon in the open ocean.
So they are single-celled
algae, yes.
Just floating around in the ocean.
Exactly. They actually form the base of the food web in the open ocean. So krill eat phytoplankton, and then krill are consumed by fish and penguins and whales. So the phytoplankton is actually that very base of the food web there.
To seaweed. So seaweed is a kind of algae as well, correct?
Seaweed is an algae, yes. So seaweed is actually a macroalgae. So that means it has a blade, so a big thallus, as well as a stipe and a holdfast, which it uses to attach to a rocky substrate or some other structure.
So if the microscopic algae are having trouble growing, obviously, as you're saying, it kind of makes sense that larger algae would have trouble growing. So what's the importance of the iron then?
Yeah, so iron is very important for algae growth, both microalgae and macroalgae, and this is well documented in the literature. Iron is really important in photosynthesis. It actually controls the electron transport in the photosynthetic pathway in seaweeds and in phytoplankton. It's also really important in nitrogen uptake. So the enzymes which convert nitrogen in the cells, in the seaweed cells and the algae cells, they're actually made up of iron. So when you have limiting iron concentrations, you actually have reduced photosynthesis and reduce nitrogen uptake, which obviously then links to an actual overall reduced growth of the algae and of the seaweed in our case, which we found.
Did you go out into the open ocean and test this, or did you do this another way?
Yeah, so this experiment was conducted in a lab. We did use open ocean seawater. So I didn't personally go into the Southern Ocean, but there was a cruise a few years ago on the Investigator, which is the CSIRO's research vessel. They went down, I think it was 2018, this seawater was collected, and in trace metal free conditions. So they take these carboys and they make sure they're really, really clean and there's no potential contamination from any other metal sources. And they sample the seawater at about 20 meters depth and then transport it up onto the vessel and make sure it's all really secure and then there's going to be trace metal free. And that ensures that we've got a representative seawater sample from the Southern Ocean or from wherever you're taking your open ocean seawater sample from.
Yeah. And then what did you do? You grew seaweed in that seawater sample?
We did. So we took that seawater back to our lab down at IMAS, the Institute for Marine Antarctic Studies in Hobart. I constructed a trace metal free positive pressure bubble. So we used a laminar flow hood, which actually sucks in air through a filter and then pushes it out through the front opening. And this filter actually strips the air of any potential metals. So in that environment is very, very clean and then we have no contamination. And we built a big plastic bubble around this laminar flow hood. So it created this positive pressure bubble with that filtered laminar flow airflow into the bubble. And then we had a door which flaps open when you've got the air passing out to make sure that no iron or no other metals are actually able to get into that bubble. This ensures it's a very clean environment and that we're not having any contamination in that ocean seawater. We have these little chambers, which I made out of plastic bottles that we had drilled holes in the top. And through these holes, we used silicon tubing. And again, you're making sure that there's going to be no potential contamination getting into these little bottles. So you've got air filters that are attached to these tubes at the top. So for the seaweeds to grow in these chambers, we had to have the seawater and we've also got to have airflow. So you've got to introduce carbon dioxide for the seaweeds to be able to photosynthesize. By having these tubes that feed through the top of these jars with air filters on them, we're ensuring that there was no contamination from the air actually going inside our experimental containers. And then we cut the seaweed into approximately 5 centimeter round discs and we make sure that they're clean of phytoplankton because phytoplankton can also sit on the surface of seaweed and live there before placing them in these chambers. We controlled the amount of iron in these chambers. We had a gradient. So we had 7 concentrations in total, ranging from 0 nanomoles of iron. And then we went all the way up to 40 nanomoles of dissolved iron. And we did this gradient so we could span environmentally relevant. So at that really low concentration or no iron in open ocean seawater versus a more of a coastal situation. So where we do see a lot of seaweeds growing and we know that the iron concentrations are suitable for growing seaweed.
What did you find? Did you find that adding more grew better seaweed or more seaweed?
Yeah, yes, absolutely. So we found that at the low iron concentrations, our seaweeds were, I mean, they died very quickly. This experiment ran for 2 weeks and it was meant to run for longer than 2 weeks. We actually had to cut it short at that 2 week mark because the seaweeds spanning from the 0 nanomoles of iron up to about 20 nanomoles of dissolved iron actually were starting to fall apart and they had very low pigment contents and they were degrading. So they weren't able to actually survive in that low iron environment versus when we looked at the higher iron concentration. So at 45 to 120 nanomoles of dissolved iron, you see some beautiful, highly pigmented seaweed growth. They did grow better. we determined at the end of the experiment that the iron concentrations in the open ocean are actually 1,000-fold lower than are required for seaweed growth. And this was the massive finding from this experiment.
So ultimately, if someone did want to grow seaweed artificially in the open ocean, they're going to have to add iron to the ocean.
Yes, and this is the big thing that we concluded as part of this research was that if you wanted to start growing seaweed in the open ocean, you are going to have to fertilize with iron. And this comes with its own suite of issues in terms of gaining social license. So it's currently actually illegal to fertilize the ocean with iron at the moment. And this is because in the early 2000s, they started doing these iron fertilization experiments and just realized that it wasn't going to be a feasible or very environmentally friendly thing to actually do. And in turn, when you consider growing seaweed in the open ocean, if you want to also include that iron fertilization, you then have a compounded perturbation of the open ocean. You're not only introducing seaweeds, you're also introducing extra iron. And that's going to have a whole suite of effects in terms of changing the open ocean ecology. In our low iron concentrations, we saw significant dissolved organic carbon release by the seaweeds. So this organic carbon that is released by the seaweeds is then consumed by the microbes, the bacteria that are living in the ocean. It's actually their food source. So you could potentially be changing the ratio of bacteria and phytoplankton in the open ocean compared to what is currently naturally occurring there.
And that's all going to have an impact on the carbon levels in the seawater and all of the, and probably atmospheric carbon as well.
Absolutely. There are so many unknowns associated with this that will need ongoing research before I think it's an actually considered a potential carbon dioxide removal strategy, one that's actually going to, benefit and actually cause a reduction in the carbon dioxide levels, which is the whole point of this.
Thank you for joining us on the show this week, Dr. Payne.
Thank you for having me.
That's all we have time for on another episode of Lost in Science. Thanks for listening. Lost in Science is recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nations and the Ngunnawal people and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the kind support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you would like to get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. You can drop us a line at lostinsci@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, where we are Lost in Science on 3CR. Or you can just tune in wherever you find us, on your radio, on your podcast, next week when Chris, Stu, Lyndon and Claire get Lost in Science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.